A podcast of the cinema.
Starring?
You, Dave White.
That's correct.
Everybody back away for the star. The star is here.
There's only one star in a Helen Lawson show, and that's me, baby. Remember?
Yes. You're a veritable Isaac Mizrahi. And I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm here, too.
We're film critics. We're married to each other. Alonzo has jobs. I have dinner to make. That's pretty much it.
You have the many podcasts of the Linoleum Knife Network.
Well, there is that, yeah. And who knows? Listen, looks like freelance reviewers are coming back to your employer maybe soon, hopefully, we think, is what's going on. And I'll be last hired. But, you know, it's fine.
We'll see what happens. It's very exciting. It's an exciting time.
I have to be the last hired back on because, you know,
yeah,
I'm like married to the reviews editor.
Right.
So, yeah, it goes. How was your time out into the great terrifying world this morning?
Oh, my God. So terrifying.
You traumatized.
I think I needed to baby step this a little more. I really loaded.
You did not baby step this. When you texted me and said, "Oh, I'm going to Target," I was like, "You're what?"
I know. I should have rethought that.
You're doing what?
Because yeah, I y'all talk to your doctor about getting a colonoscopy.
Right.
Over the age of 35, you know.
I thought it was over 40.
Well,
or
depends.
50 or that's whatever.
At 35, you should start asking about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Maybe they'll tell you later. They told me 35 because...
You have a family history, though.
I do.
I do not. And they said to me when I turned 50
yes.
that was when it should start. And that is when it did start.
Right. But I'm just saying, talk to your doctor. They'll tell you when you need to start. But once you need to start, do them. And do them regularly. Do them when your doctor
right.
tells you to do them.
Right.
We have friends who are alive today because they did them on a very regular basis. And yeah. so, and again, yeah, I have a family history of it, so it's a big deal. Anyway, I'm having a colonoscopy this week. Fun times.
It's going to be great. Your prep for this.
Well, yeah.
Is really ruining my menu plan.
So in addition to the usual prep, which involves like things you can't eat and horrible things you must drink that will... run right through your system
yeah.
because that's makes what you, they're designed to do.
It makes you spotless.
Yes.
Yeah.
I also had to go get my very first COVID test.
In order to get the colonoscopy now, you have to have the COVID test.
Yeah.
And even, we've been hiding in here for 14 months.
Exactly.
And we didn't get a COVID test because we didn't go anywhere or do anything.
Yeah, we were under the blanket the whole time.
And you got your first one today.
Yeah.
How'd that feel?
A little intrusive, but not as I was expecting worse from the way that people were describing it. So, but yeah, so I had to go do that and had to go pick up my, you know, gross powder that will become the gross liquid that I will be consuming very soon.
Yes.
And then on the way home, I thought, oh, I'll go to Target so I can pick up other little snackies and clear fluids for me to be enjoying in the next
right.
few days.
Because all there is in this house for like, since March of last year is things that are good for you and are off the list for the colonoscopy.
Yeah.
We went nearly full vegetarian the past 14 months. So that means
all of your legumes
vegetables
and nuts
and
beans
seeds and yeah, everything
off the menu,
everything that is, you know,
fibrous,
good for your down there area. Yeah. You can't have it on colonoscopy week.
Right.
No. No broccoli.
Nope. So I thought, I'll pop into Target and pick up a couple of things. Well, I went into a new Target. The former Husk. There was this infamous half-built Target that had been rotting away on Sunset Boulevard for a long time. It was
stalled in mid-construction because of who knows why.
Yeah, I forget the reasons. But like there was even...
It wound up with its own Twitter account.
There was a Twitter account for the Target Husk. But now it's a real, honest-to-gosh Target. They finally finished it. Then it's open for business. And I have not set foot in a Target in over a year. And to set foot in one that I'd never been in before, so I didn't know the layout like the back of my hand, was a little disconcerting.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So I grabbed what I needed and got the heck out of there. I didn't allow myself to sort of, you know, dawdle through the cereal aisle or anything. So
I was stunned that you texted me.
Yeah, it was... In retrospect, not a good idea. Oh, and then part of the reason I went was because I didn't have breakfast before going because I had to get blood work. And I thought, well, if they want to take my blood pressure, I don't want to have drunk coffee yet because that always throws off my numbers.
Right.
So I thought I'll go to Target. Targets always have Starbucks in them.
And was there the Starbucks?
There is a Starbucks near Target. Yeah. However.
Yes.
At the moment, in these times.
Yes.
One may not consume food or drink while inside the store.
Oh. Okay. Why?
Masks.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, well, there's no point in that. So I didn't get anything from Starbucks and Target. I went and did my Target shopping and kind of had the tiniest of freakouts. Like, I know what a real freakout is. I was just a little like, I'm not feeling comfortable. I want to go home now.
Just to be clear, you and I are both fully vaccinated.
Yes.
2 weeks out from our second shot.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday, we left the apartment. We went to a place. We went inside. I feel like I have come out of a cave. And then I want to run back into the cave.
I think we need little short ventures out of the cave before we really go for it. The Target was maybe a little ambitious on my part. And then I went to the drive-thru Starbucks and then had the realization that Starbucks is terrible. I hadn't been to one in over a year. And it's like, oh yeah, this coffee is really bad. And the food stuff is weirdly like over-toasted on one side and under-toasted on the other.
And 1,000 degrees in the middle.
Yeah. Right. Just generally unappealing. And like Starbucks is good if you're getting like a seasonal flavor or something that involves lots of syrups and whipped cream and stuff.
Hot cocoa.
Yeah. But if you're going just
little
for like...
vanilla bean scones.
I just went in for like a cold brew with some half and half. And it's like... scuttlebutt is people who talk about this stuff. Starbucks apparently burns the beans intentionally.
I don't know anything about this.
So when they're doing the roasting process, they over roast them to make them have them a longer shelf life.
Okay.
And so that's why coffee at Starbucks always tastes like it's been burnt. This champagne is burnt.
I only get coffee at DuPars.
Because you only get coffee in quotation marks.
We've had this discussion before, and I will not be told that my love of a specific type of diner coffee is wrong.
It's fine.
It is fine.
You have what you like.
I do have what I like.
Anyway, I used
all
to,
the time.
I used to be a Starbucks aficionado, but I think now the bloom is off the rose.
How much money did you put on your app, though?
$15.
How much did you spend?
Like 13, as it turned out.
Oh, okay, great. So next time we're near one, we'll pop in, we'll get some vanilla bean scones.
Yes.
Because those are still quite nice.
Sure.
And then...
They got rid of the chorizo sandwich, which I know you liked.
I did. That was, you know, if you were going there,
and
sometimes that's what you would get from
me. And they got rid of the morning bun, which was like my favorite thing.
Sure. There are plenty of other good things to eat in the world.
Yes.
None of them are at Starbucks.
Yes, absolutely. Agreed. No argument here.
Well, good. My little moment of complaint this morning about, you know, it's been so nice to save all this money on Starbucks.
That had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, but I feel good about it.
If I had gone to Starbucks and it was delicious, I'd have been spending that money.
I know.
Buying all the Hummel figurines.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a podcast of the cinema.
I suppose it is.
We're going to talk about that.
Mm.
Got four movies to review.
Yes. Five.
Oh, that's right. Can you get that one out of the way?
Fine.
Can you get that one out of the way that you saw that is just hideous and bad? All right.
Dave is talking about Here Today, starring, co-written by, and directed by Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
Co-written by Alan Zweibel, who for TV did a lot of great stuff with the early Saturday Night Live, and at the movies has given us North, among other things. So, you know, it's a mixed record at best. Billy Crystal stars as a writer named Charlie Burns, and we know this because in all the flashbacks with his wife where she's talking to the camera, she calls him Charlie Burns 80,000 times.
All right.
And I call you Dave White. And
you
still,
call me Dave White every day of my life.
But I don't call you Dave White in every sentence the way this woman does.
Okay.
Every time. It's, oh, Charlie Burns, you're so funny.
I'm like Charlie Brown to our group of friends because everyone calls me by my first and last name.
Well, there are a lot of Daves in the world.
We do the same thing to Gary Cotti.
Yes.
I'm not sure why, because there's only one Gary.
It rolls off the tongue.
I mean, we know a couple, but...
Gary Cotti.
It does roll off the tongue. It's like a one name.
Yeah.
He might as well be named Cher or Madonna. Gary Cotti. Because this is Gary Cotti.
Yeah. Friend and neighbor.
Continue.
Anyway, so Charlie Burns is a comedy legend. He, you know, wrote for TV. He's had plays on Broadway. He's written screenplays of beloved films. But he is approaching more and more the you know, a state of dementia. When he walks to work at the live comedy cable show that he works on, he has to like tell himself, okay, stop sign, take a left, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
He has like post-its on his bulletin board to remind him who people are and their names, including members of his own family. One day he has lunch with a singer played by Tiffany Haddish.
Okay.
He thinks that she won this lunch with him in like a library auction. Turns out her ex-boyfriend did, and she stole the lunch and went to go hang out with him. She orders the seafood salad, has a terrible allergic reaction. He takes her to the hospital, and suddenly they're like mismatched buddies.
Okay.
Her singing career is taking off, but she is ultimately more than willing to just give it up for now so that she can take care of Charlie because his dementia is getting worse.
How quickly do they become this close?
They have like that awkward lunch, and then they run into each other not long after, where she apparently has no insurance. She has to pay all this money at the hospital for all of her stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so like she will show up periodically to like pay him, and she pays him in like singles, which at first he thinks, are you a stripper? But it turns out, no, she is a blues singer, and she goes around the audience and they tip
her. She sings for tips.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, this is a really awful movie. And things, I don't even hate it nearly as much as Christy Lemire does,
okay,
who thought it's like one of the worst films she's ever seen. It's just like really sappy. It's not funny. And it's not even
Tiffany Haddish.
Not particularly. No.
And
there are moments, they have that feel like they had to have been improvised, where they like walk through Madame Tussauds and say goofy things about the celebrities.
Uh-huh.
And those aren't funny. It's also one of those movies that is about comedy, and the comedy being created within the movie is never funny.
Yeah.
Ever. Like
so often the case.
With the only exception I could think of off the top of my head is when, blanking on the name of the actress from Obvious Child.
Jenny Slate.
Thank you. Right. Jenny Slate's stand-up in Obvious Child,
yeah,
is funny.
I don't remember. I'm going to say that you're right.
I remember that because movies about stand-up comics, movies about like live, you know, comedy SNL type shows, movies about like talk show gag writers.
Right.
The comedy they create in those movies are never funny. And those movies are made generally by people in the world of comedy.
Right.
So I don't understand how that works. So that's terrible for one thing. Then you get the whole thing of like where, you know, this woman just gives up her career ambitions to take care of this guy that she has not known for very long.
For no reason, or because he paid for her hospital bill?
No, just because they become pals.
Like, okay.
It's also a movie in which, even though he has a somewhat strained relationship with his children for a reason that isn't explained until very late in the film, He is this legend of comedy, you know, like the producer of the show that he works on, you know, like when other writers are complaining about him, like defends him as being this like staunch defender of what's really funny, you know. He goes to like a Q&A at Lincoln Center of some movie that he wrote. And so basically the whole movie is people telling him how funny he is. And it's Billy Crystal playing a character that he has written and that he is directing, and he is directing the other people in the movie to tell him how funny he is. And that gets great. Uncomfortable also.
I love it.
Anyway, don't bother. It's out there now.
Tell me the name of it again.
Here Today.
Did they name it that so that people would instantly forget what it was called?
If they did, kudos.
It makes me feel bad for Tiffany Haddish because I think she's wonderful.
She is. She gets to sing a lot in this movie, which maybe she wanted to do and nobody else was letting her.
I didn't know she sang.
I didn't either. Okay. She's pretty good.
All right.
She does that Your Feet's Too Big song or whatever. Do you know that one?
No.
It's an old blues song.
Okay.
And like three or four other ones.
Okay. Well, if I ever feel like I need to complete the list of seeing every film Tiffany Haddish is in, maybe someday I'll watch this.
It might be better otherwise, than the no. Tiffany Haddish movie that Tyler Perry directed. Remember that one?
I do, and I don't remember the name of that
Nobody's
one either.
Nobody's Fool.
And it was also very bad.
Yes.
You know what? Just because you like a funny person who's funny, you know, in ways that are really wonderful, doesn't mean every project that they're in is going to be worth their time.
I can see...
Or yours to watch.
I can see where, for her, it's like, oh, this comedy legend, you know,
Billy Crystal
wants to work with me because I'm you know, still kind of an up-and-comer. Like, right. On paper, no, I get why you said
I would feel like that if I were her, too. I'd be like, well, here's my opportunity. I can work with Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
All right. Can we talk about something good?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's talk about Street Gang.
Oh, yeah.
Street Gang is the story of Sesame Street.
Mm-hmm.
It is very much like the Mr. Rogers documentary that came out a couple years ago. And was that Won't You Be My Neighbor?
That's Won't You Be My Neighbor. The Tom Hanks is A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Okay. Right? Okay. All right. So before Sesame Street, children's TV was sort of this proto version of what it is now, a way to sell toys and candy and
cereal.
They have a clip from, I don't know which show it is, but
is it Pinky Lee?
I'll just say it was Pinky Lee because Pinky Lee was very much this kind of children's TV host.
Hang on real quick. I got him backwards. Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Is the documentary.
Is the documentary, right? Okay, sorry.
We said it right the first time.
Okay, sorry.
Like, you see a clip of him saying, tell your mom you want Tootsie Roll.
Yeah.
Demand it.
Pitch a fit.
So, a woman named Joan Gans Cooney and a man named Lloyd Morissette Jr. They founded the Children's Television Workshop, and they had this idea that children's television could be something. It could be something good. It could be something meaningful. It could be a way to help children learn very easy reading and writing and counting, you know, mathematical and, you know, stuff like that before they get into school. If you could figure out a way to catch their attention and make it so that they could easily remember what you're telling them, you could really improve the lives of little kids, particularly kids in marginalized communities where maybe there's not a book in the house.
Yeah.
You know? And so they decided, you know, to go to commercial jingles because they were noticing that the children in their personal lives could sing you the theme song from the Budweiser commercial.
Right, from repetition.
So they thought, all right, well, let's make this show happen. And it was all the right people in the right place at the right moment. You had Jim Henson's Muppets. They brought them on board. Songwriter Joe Raposo, who was great at making songs where you count to 12 and it's a 15 second song and it's really catchy and you want to sing it over and over again. And You'll learn how to count to 12 if you're three.
We don't talk about Joe Raposo nearly enough.
No,
we like do the not. Way that we talk about the Sherman Brothers.
Yeah.
We should be talking about Joe Raposo.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Like, that's the song. I'm 57 years old. Well, I'll be 57 in June. I'm 56 years old. 51 years ago, I heard that song for the first time. And I heard it again and again and again. Now, I was 5 when Sesame Street came on the air. I already knew how to count to 12 when I was 5. But that song lodged itself in my head. It's barely a song. It's a snippet of a song.
I mean, he also wrote, like, The People in Your Neighborhood and It's Not Easy Being Green. And
the Ladybug Picnic song.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, which is another one, counting to 12.
I think it's 11 at the Ladybug Picnic.
Sure, whatever. However many it was. However many ladybugs you were counting in the song. In any case, they also found a director for the show, a guy named John Stone, who was fiercely devoted to this concept and had a very strong sense of the rightness of what they were doing. He said, all these people who were on a mission to make this show something wonderful for little kids. And they did it.
Yeah.
The film itself has, you know, lots of archival footage, lots of behind the scenes stuff, a lot of information about how the creators learned what they needed to know as time went on. Like, they were balancing out some of the Muppet sketches with, you know, the live action people and keeping them separate. And then they realized that the test children watching the show before it ever aired were not, they were tuning out when it was just the human beings. So they decided to incorporate the Muppets into the human beings.
So Big Bird and Oscar.
So Big Bird, Oscar, Kermit, Grover, they all suddenly were part of
the street itself
rather than little discrete standalone moments where it was only them.
Like Ernie and Bert's apartment is in the same brownstone as like Gordon and Susan's, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, so much, again, so much background you didn't know about the original Gordon named Matt Robinson, guy named Matt Robinson. Guess whose father he is? You suddenly, you're watching this documentary and you see Holly Robinson Pete on the camera and you're like, were you on Sesame Street?
Were you one of the kids?
No. Her dad was the first Gordon.
Yes. Who was my Gordon.
Yeah. Like, he's Gordon to me because when
the bald guy came in, I was like, you're second Gordon.
Second Gordon. Yeah.
You're like other Darren.
I only watched the show from 5 to what? Maybe 7.
Yeah.
By then the electric company was on and that was more where I needed to be in terms of what they were delivering to me. But it was on right before the electric company, so I was still kind of watching it because, you know, it doesn't really matter how old you are, the Muppets are great. You want to watch the Muppets.
And the animated things too are fun.
Also that, yeah. But she
You're not a cow.
Holly Robinson Pete saying, so I turn on the TV and there's my father, and I'm thinking, how did you get inside the box? And why are you not turning around to look at me and say hello to me? I'm right here. And who's that other little child standing next to you on the street? And why are you walking down the street holding her hand and not mine? All the things you would think about if you were, you know, 3 or 4 watching your parents on television.
It's interesting that they, you know, they. It's not just about the launch of the show. It's about sort of different issues they dealt with over time. They don't talk about the Snuffleupagus conundrum.
That was a long, long story that is not in the film at all.
Yeah.
In fact, there is no Snuffleupagus in the film.
Yeah. There was a whole thing where Big Bird had a friend named Snuffleupagus. No, through farcical setups, nobody ever saw Snuffleupagus, and everybody assumed that Big Bird had an imaginary friend, and he kept trying to convince him, no, really, he's real, and no one would ever believe him. And then at some point, they realized that, you know, as the public cultural conversation around abuse was including the idea that children need to be believed, and children should be able to find an adult they trust and tell them things.
Yes.
That Big Bird needed to be believed by the other people on Sesame Street. And so there was a whole big thing where one day they finally saw Snuffleupagus and understood that Big Bird had been telling the truth the whole time. That doesn't come up in the film.
No.
They do cover the death of Mr. Hooper.
The death of Mr. Hooper.
Which is devastating.
It's devastating. It will make you cry watching it again. One of the reasons, I'm glad you brought up the Snuffleupagus thing, because one of the reasons they decided to make it so that people did believe Big Bird is because originally, before the Elmo years, which were far less, that was like the 90s.
Yeah.
Before the Elmo years, Big Bird was the proxy child. He was the Muppet child on the show. He was the character that children could look at and say, oh, he's learning these things the way I'm learning these things.
The holy innocent.
Yeah. And so I didn't really consider that at the time, that Big Bird was supposed to be the character that I was closest to, but because I actually truly mostly loved
Ernie.
Oscar. Oh. And because Oscar would say terrible things to people and laugh about it. And other people were like, oh, we love him anyway, you know.
Oscar was committed to his contrarianism, so I could see where he really...
I learned that Southern television stations didn't want to carry it at first.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because they presented a world where people of all races lived happily together on the same block.
Yeah.
And a lot of Southern television stations were like, no, we're not showing that.
But the show became such a cultural juggernaut that they finally had to give in.
They had to give in. You get outtakes of Muppets swearing.
Oh, that's always fun.
It is just an overall wonderful film about how really committed, smart people learned how to make a thing that lasted and was a force for good in the world. So it's not just nostalgia.
No.
That you want to see this for. It's
inspiration.
It's the history of the thing that saved children's television from itself.
And I think also it's very easy when a show reaches its 50th anniversary the way Sesame Street has to kind of take its existence for granted. You know, to think, oh, well, there's always been a Sesame Street. Well, yeah, in our lifetimes, there's always been a Sesame Street, but not that long before that, there was nothing like it at all. And somebody had to create this thing, which, you know, in turn opened the door for other shows that could take those risks and, you know, be about something besides selling crap to children. And so I think it's always important to remember, like, where did these things come from? How do they exist despite the odds? And, you know, I think they're inspirational for anybody who wants to sort of shake up the paradigm of anything. Anytime you want to introduce something like this, where people tell you, oh, we don't do that. Nobody does that. That'll never work. This is why you could never. You look at something like Sesame Street, you know, which nobody was clamoring for, and they made it happen.
Yeah. Story of a 3-day pass.
Mm-hmm.
1968.
Yes.
It has been restored, and it has been re-released into art house theaters and will be streaming soon.
I would
imagine.
Is
that correct?
I believe
Pretty
so.
Pretty sure. Yeah. I'll tell you, the non-restored version was already streaming last year on Amazon Prime. And there's an older DVD version that you can still get, but they made a 4K restoration of this film, 1968, from director Melvin Van Peebles, who would go on to make Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song
a couple years later.
And I had never seen this.
Me neither.
Until this past week. And It's astonishing. But first, let's talk a little bit about Melvin Van Peebles, because that man, still alive.
Yes.
That man is the guy who got told, you can't do that. You're not allowed to do that. And he said, oh, really?
Watch.
And then just did it. He made some short films in the, I guess, the 50s. I haven't seen them either. Went to Hollywood, met with some studios. These studios are not named. But one of them offered a job to him as an elevator operator.
Mm.
And he got so fed up with the way that Hollywood stood in front of black creators, right, and said no, that he went to France. Now, the cultural conversation about France in the 20th century, in the mid-century, mm-hmm, was that if you were black and you were an artist, an actor, a dancer, a singer, a musician, a writer, you could go to France, you could go to Paris, and they wouldn't treat you horribly.
Yeah.
Like,
if you were a jazz artist, they would revere you.
The racism of the United States, the story went,
yes,
did not exist in France.
So James Baldwin went, a lot of...
Right. This was not the case, however.
Right.
There's an entire documentary that came out last year about this very subject called The Myth of a Colorblind France.
Correct.
But, comparatively, black artists had it somewhat easier.
Yes.
Over there. So he goes to Paris. He writes a novel called La Permission. That gives him entry into the Directors Guild. And there was a grant involved.
There's a cultural, at the time in France, it was a cultural grant where you would get $60,000 to, yeah, adapt your own novel into a film. With the proviso that the film be of artistic merit, if not necessarily commercial merit. And so he got the $60,000, he got a producer, and was eventually able to put together a $200,000 budget for this film. And, you know, it's based, you can definitely sense the new wave influence on the editing, for sure.
Yeah, the French new wave was clearly something that he was, you know,
Absorbing,
as well as, you know, filmmakers from African countries like Ousmane Sembene, mm, from Senegal. The rhythms of that storytelling and the rhythms of editing of all those influences found their way into this film, which, yeah, is the story of a man, an American GI stationed in France, played by Harry Baird.
Yes.
And it opens with him looking in a mirror, having a conversation with himself. He's very happy because he thinks he's about to get a promotion within the military. Are you shaking the table or are we having an earthquake?
I'm shaking the table.
Okay.
Sorry.
I never know. He thinks he's about to get a promotion and he's very excited, but his reflection begins speaking back to him and saying, they're only promoting you because you are obedient to the white authority. I'm paraphrasing what his reflection says to him. But then we find out that the reflection is actually telling the truth, because the commanding officer says, oh, I like you because I trust you because you obey.
Yes.
Yeah. He says it explicitly to him.
You aren't a troublemaker.
You aren't a troublemaker. So he gives him a 3-day pass. Turner is the name of the soldier. He goes off to Paris. He's sort of adrift, sort of alone for a while. He tries to strike up conversations with people, tries to strike up conversations with various women. No one wants to talk with him. No one wants to be with him. He goes to a nightclub, and he floats into the nightclub on a double dolly shot that would eventually become Spike Lee's signature move.
Right.
And he meets a woman named Miriam, played by Nicole Berger. And they have a little two-day, three-day romance. And very near the end of it, some of his
fellow soldiers, the white fellow soldiers,
happen upon them. Yes, white guys. And he becomes worried that they're going to, you know, tell on him.
CEO.
Yeah, because one of the things the CEO is dead set against
the commanding officer.
Did I say CEO?
Yes, you did.
Sorry. One of the things the commanding officer says is, you know, basically, do not let me catch you with a white woman.
Yeah. Just because we're in Europe, it doesn't mean...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a film that is having a conversation, not only with the audience, but with itself, about systemic racism, both in the United States, in the institutions of the United States, but abroad as well.
Yes.
And it is about, you know, being othered from the point of view of the person that it's happening to. It's not a guess who's coming to dinner kind of movie where you're supposed to sort of, you know,
relate to the white people.
Relate to the white people. You are meant to be seeing this world from Turner's perspective.
Yes.
From Harry Baird's perspective.
Although there are moments where you see it from Miriam's perspective.
Yes, as well. And we'll leave that for people to see because it's a bit flabbergasting to watch what is going through their minds, their you know, respective minds as they
have sex for the
sort
first
of
time.
Deeper into each other's presence. For me, there's this one sort of indelible scene where he is confronted by a racist man, I think a man from Spain.
Yeah, they go to a restaurant. She tells them that all the actual French restaurants in Normandy are touristy. So they go to the Spanish restaurant where there's like a flamenco performance going on. And then afterwards, the Spanish entertainer comes out and says
something not good
to
him. And he takes
umbrage.
Naturally, he takes offense to this. And her reaction to it is, oh, no, no, that didn't happen. Meanwhile, you, the audience, can see it and hear it happening.
Yeah.
And the character of Turner sees it and hears it happening. And she tells him, no, 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 you didn't hear him properly. That's not what happened. It didn't happen. And so it's this weird moment of what a white person will do to keep the situation under control. What a white person will do to convince themselves that racism isn't happening around them.
Mm.
To the point of telling the person of color that it is also not happening to them.
Right.
This is a film from 1968.
Yeah.
These are conversations that people are still having right now. It's the most exciting, and I don't want to give away the ending because there's so much more to come after this. It's the most exciting 50-plus-year-old movie that I've seen in a while. I couldn't have told you much, honestly, about Melvin Van Peebles. Before this film. But now I've done my homework on him, and what an exciting artist he was. And I don't think people have given him enough, you know, attention.
Yeah, no, I mean, he really is a pioneer in a lot of ways of indie American cinema, of Black American cinema, obviously. And, you know, I think the reverberations of his relatively, you know, handful of films that he's made that are well known, like, continue to be super influential and important.
Yeah.
You know, his son Mario did a film called Badass, which was kind of a biopic of the making of Sweet Sweetback, where he plays his own father.
Right.
I have not seen that. I need to. But yeah, no, he's a essential figure.
So currently this is playing theatrically in New York and Los Angeles.
Yes.
I assume some streaming situation, a Blu-ray is coming. Every time they do a 4K,
there's a Blu-ray.
There's a Blu-ray on the way. That's like, you can save that rhyme for yourself.
I will say this. You know, like if you're dying to see this, rather than watch whatever the previous version that might be still streaming out there somewhere, wait and watch the 4K because I suspect it's going to look tons better and it's going to be a lot clearer and sharper. It's a black and white film. It'll probably look a lot more like what it looked like in 1968.
Yeah. It's great. Don't miss this one.
Yeah.
All right. Wrath of Man. Please discuss.
Okay. This is the reunion of Jason Statham and Guy Ritchie, who have not made a film together for more than 10 years. In my review for The Wrap, I went out of my way to avoid spoiling what I thought was a major plot twist, but apparently it's right there in the trailer, so I don't even know if we should talk about it or not.
If it's right there in the trailer, you can talk about it. Tell me what this film is about.
Okay.
I did see it, but I'm speaking on behalf of the audience a lot.
I'm getting there. I just wanted to check with you about what we were going to say and not say. So Statham plays a guy who goes to work for an armored car company. We have seen this armored car company suffer a truck jacking at the beginning of the film. It's like one static camera in the back, and we see these guys pull up with a cement truck. They kill the drivers. They take the money. It's a whole thing. We're going to be coming back to this robbery several times in the film because it's a major plot motor. So Statham goes to work for this company. Barely squeaks by on the marksmanship and the truck handling and other things like that. Like, seems like he's just going to be average, but it's Jason Statham, so we know that he's going to be superhuman. And indeed, his first day out on a real job, when people try to hold one of the drivers hostage, he very coolly dispatches like six or seven would-be thieves, just shoots them point blank or with deadly accuracy from a distance. And so obviously this guy has more going on beneath the surface than we know about. Meanwhile, we see that the truck job that opened the movie was perpetrated by a gang of veterans. They were not criminals before, but they all have various reasons, whether it's financial or just not, their own self-therapy of not having enough to do, having come home from Afghanistan. They decide they're going to start knocking over these armored cars, and at some point their storyline and Jason Statham's storyline are going to meet.
Yeah. This one kind of bothered me. Not because of the tone, which is much gloomier and moodier than earlier Guy Ritchie film.
Or even The Gentleman.
Yeah. It is very effectively the kind of film it wants to be.
Yeah. It's not particularly funny, which his movies...
There's often quite a bit of comedy in a Guy Ritchie film when it's, dude, 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 one woman.
Mm-hmm.
All right. He often feels like he's exploring the idea of machismo as much as he is indulging in it.
Sure.
And that's not the case here. This is really just the machismo. There doesn't feel like there's any
exploration
at all. Certainly no comic exploration, which frequently has happened in the past.
Right.
Statham is, as I said on KCRW last week, the handsome granite human that audiences have come to enjoy, because in this film, it's the one thing he's called on to do, and it's often the one thing he's called on to do in lots of the other films he's in, except for, Spy.
Right. And even then, he's playing a comedic version of that same thing.
Right. But over the course of his career, this is sort of a consistency that has engendered affection.
Sure.
From people.
In my review for The Wrap, I said, Jason Statham is Jason Statham in the way that Cary Grant was always Cary Grant.
Right. You know he's capable of more than this, but he's really good at this. So, quite often, this has a feeling of a Nicholas Winding Refn, like how you like,
Winding Refn.
Is that the right way to say that, his last name? I always thought that I was being silly.
Winding Refn.
I always thought I was being silly when I pronounced.
No, it is Winding like, Winding Refn. Apparently,
okay. Sorry, filmmaker whose name I'm having trouble pronouncing. There are elements of this film that feel like they come out of his world.
Mm.
You know, that extremely moody lighting and the way the men talk to each other. Everything feels cryptic. Everything feels full of doom.
Macho nihilism.
Yeah. And, but it's, if it had only been that, if it had only been man, kill, other man, because so many people get shot and murdered in this film.
And one of the things in its favor, I think, is that there are a lot of characters and there is a mystery through a good chunk of the film about who the turncoat is.
Right.
And we have a lot of possibilities, which a lot of movies, you know, they kind of, they undersell, you know, they give you two characters and you know one of them has to be it, you know.
So you and I have had this discussion a couple times now since watching it. There are like seven women in this film.
Yeah.
Seven female characters. All of them are inconsequential.
Yeah.
They are either cogs in the machine of the plot, or they exist to have sex with Jason Statham and then be murdered, or they have no name at all and they are like sex trafficked underage girls.
Yeah.
And it's dispiriting because Guy Ritchie has always been a filmmaker who has been like fixated on tough guys and their inconsistencies and those weird homosocial narratives of camaraderie, right? Mm-hmm. But he has also always, generally, usually, included, as I said earlier, at least one woman
right
in that gang. Generally,
more than hold her own.
Who, yeah, I mean, she's that woman, that female character is often put on kind of a pedestal, but she always sort of strides through the film.
Yeah.
Not letting the men get the best of her, you know, outsmarting them, giving them information they need so that she can get the thing that she wants
right
out of this crime scenario that's revolving around her. That's not happening here. It's extremely disappointing. It's like he did.
Is it because it's a remake? We haven't seen the French film.
I don't care
that
if
it's a
remake. I mean, it is a remake, yes. But
that doesn't mean
you can take liberties with a remake.
Sure.
You can make things different.
He put interesting women in The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yes. So, especially, you know,
his remake of Swept Away, maybe not so much.
Not room for a single woman of any, you know, narrative consequence
right
in this film. And it's just, especially when there are so many, you know, when they, almost all of them, except for like, not almost all of them, I'd say more than half of them come to a bad end. The other three or ish come to no end. Like, you don't know what happens
to
them.
They aren't, they don't even,
they just disappear.
They're not, not only are they not plot motors, they're not anything.
Yeah, like, you never find out what happens to them because the film doesn't care.
Yeah.
And it super bums me out that this filmmaker who has been smarter and more human in the past is doing this.
I agree, totally. I think there are things this movie might have in its favor in terms of, I like the way that information unfolds in this movie,
right.
I think is handled well.
Yes.
There's an interesting ensemble of male actors who get things to do. Eddie Marzan, Josh Hartnett, Rob Delaney.
Right.
But yes, ultimately, I think the woman problem of this movie does weigh on it because you know that he's capable of better than this.
Right. It's this jagged rock in my shoe. Mm. It makes me not enjoy the enjoyable stuff.
Sure.
About the film, you know, because, you know, I like a heist. I like a violent heist. I like a, you know, man, kill, 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 mm-hmm. other man. It's, why?
Yeah.
Why did you do this the way you did it?
Yeah.
Why? There seems to be no reason other than unexamined misogyny. Mm. And I'm done. I want to now talk about State Funeral.
Ah, yes.
It's amazing. Sergei Loznitsa?
Mm-hmm.
Hope I got that right. He's from Ukraine. This is a entirely archival documentary about the death of Joseph Stalin.
And when he says entirely archival, he means no narration, no voiceover interviews, not even that many chirons of time and place.
Right.
It's
some,
just...
There's some location.
Some location things, chirons. And you see the progress from the announcement of the death to the actual funeral and, you know, that kind of thing. This movie pretty much just kind of plunges you into all of this, I'm assuming, newsreel footage.
Yeah.
And you're off.
So, okay, it takes place in March of 1953. Joseph Stalin has died, sort of unexpectedly. And thousands and thousands and thousands, millions even, who knows how many people, everyday people, they just flood Moscow, their own communities. People go out and gather near loudspeakers where, you know,
official government announcements.
Official information is dispensed. And the whole country is thrown into this sort of like, you know, cataclysmic mourning. So here's what happened. The Soviet Union at the time had camera operators all across the country whose jobs were to film this sort of thing for state purposes. So even in the farthest, most remote, like nearly Arctic regions,
yeah,
you know,
Kiev and Riga, and
you had camera people.
Yeah.
So all that footage was taken over the next week and then archived and not seen by pretty much anybody. So, Loznitsa took all this footage and he edited it together so that you wind up with a film that is a chronological sort of tour of like the day it happens through the big processions and funerals and the arrival of state leaders from other countries, the civilian mourners who were allowed in to look at the body because it's in a casket that has got a clear, you know.
Well, they don't put that until it goes outside.
Until it goes outside. Anyway, all of the ceremony, again, very little dialogue, people saying things until near the end where at the official funeral you get, you know, higher ranking, you know, party officials giving speeches, like uninterrupted speeches.
And before that, you do get these sort of like propagandistic sort of radio announcements about, oh, the greatness of Stalin and the greatness
his
of the communist state
and
how we will one day achieve true communism because he has laid the groundwork for our mighty blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Blah, blah.
And that's where sound and editing form a narrative.
Right.
Not just in the chronology of the situation, but in the depiction of how people are behaving, you know. So,
and what life in this country looks like versus the, you know, workers' paradise that is being described by
the loudspeakers.
By the loudspeakers.
Yeah. So, the only thing that has been changed to present it to us today, in addition to the chronology of it, mm-hmm. is that atmospheric sound has been enhanced or recreated. Mm-hmm. So, applause and, you know, morning music, like Chopin's Funeral March.
I was going to say, there's some
stuff like that.
There is diegetic music throughout.
There is some.
Yeah. Either, I don't know if it was performed like by, you know, state marching bands or if it was just the recorded, but yeah, that weaves its way through as well. It is a challenging film. I mean, it was for me just because I am not it's practically an ethnographic film in terms of no one's explaining anything to you.
Yeah.
You know, no one is pop-up videoing this movie for you. No one is, you know, no historians are coming in to tell you what you're looking at. So you have to just kind of go with it as what you are getting and what it is telling you. And I found it fascinating as this examination of like, of how propaganda works and how they just tell you these things over and over and over again, and they sell you this stuff. And when I say they, I mean all governments, because I certainly would not want, you know, somebody from Fox News to be like, oh yeah, look at what these commies do, and be like,
right.
Dude, start with the man in the mirror, because
right.
like propaganda exists in all kinds of forms in pretty much every government everywhere.
One of the takeaways as an American viewer of a certain age, you know, you and I were both born in the 1960s,
yes.
which was still
the Cold War,
the height of the Cold War. And our entire childhood up until the fall of the Berlin Wall and then the collapse of the Soviet Union was spent learning very specific stuff about the Soviet Union.
Yes.
What were we taught that was actually true?
Right.
And what were we taught that was simply our own propaganda?
Exactly.
To make sure that we hated that form of government.
Yes, and feared it.
And feared it, yeah.
You have to stand in line for shoes.
Right. So, anyway, the visual spectacle here is staggering.
Mm.
To the point of what you were saying, there is a durational aspect of this film in which, you know, you are made very aware of how long things take, how slowly official stuff happens, how slowly people have to move to sort of like trudge their way through
up the stairs,
the staircase, thing. You know, that
how
sort of
long
thing.
Speeches go at these official functions.
But there's this wonderful mix of black and white footage mm-hmm. with color footage that's sometimes played off each other, like in the same room, where the same moment is being covered just by different camera people. You know, the scale of it, the thousands and thousands of mourners sort of all gathered all across the country, in spite of brutal cold and rain. You know, there's, in contrast to the, as you were saying, the propaganda coming out of the loudspeakers mm-hmm. all across the country, the camera is showing you a lot of really awkward humanity on display. From government officials to people carrying the actual coffin
right.
near the end to, you know, everyday mourners. There's, and I said this on KCRW too, but I remembered saying it and I like it. There's the official story.
Sure.
And then there's the story of faces.
Yes.
And that's really what a lot of what you're getting here. There's a couple of moments that are just mind-blowing. Official portrait artists and sculptors are shown quickly. They're working so fast.
It's like courtroom sketch artists.
To paint.
And sculpt.
And sculpt. You know, representations of the
Stalin lying in state.
Yeah. And then there's this coffin.
You're obsessed.
I'm obsessed with this coffin.
This is like our friend Aaron with the dress box from Sex and the City.
It is
the Vivian Westwood.
It is a power coffin. It is frilly, lined with. It's coated on the outside with fabric. It's just super glamorous.
Like ruched red silk.
Deanna with Vreeland red covered. The bubble, the clear bubble top.
So that you can see him.
You can see him. It's like a space pod coffin. It's astonishing.
It's the Pucci coffin for Braniff.
Bury me in that thing. And then, you know, why are we seeing it now? Well, I'll tell you why we're seeing it now. We just got rid of a wannabe authoritarian.
Mm.
And that guys like him are all on the rise.
Oh, globally. Yeah. All over, around the world. And lest you think that this movie is, you know, not going to get into the nitty gritty of Stalin after, you know, it being him being praised, you know, throughout the film, you know, by official sources, you get the title cards at the end that tell you, like, the grim details of his genocidal reign.
Yeah.
But then also the fact that even the government of the USSR that had just put on this big state funeral sort of disavowed him, and they took
within 3 years.
Yeah, they moved his body out of the Kremlin wall, and, like, you know, it's like Stalin who, you know.
If you've seen the comedy, the bleak yes, comedy film,
The Death of Stalin,
and then you watch this, you're thinking, all right, which one of you guys got shot in the head like 2 weeks after this was over? You know what I mean?
I did. Like, I did spot Khrushchev, but the other guys, I kept thinking, which one of you was played by Jeffrey Tambor? I'm not sure.
Right. So this is an overwhelming experience.
It's really
just
fascinating.
A stunning film. It's a trip. Mm-hmm. Just about the kind of responses that this sort of power does to the people who are governed by it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. It's fantastic. It's so great. But get ready. It's two hours and 15 minutes of funeral
footage.
Yeah.
Do you have a DVD pick this week?
Streaming? Do I?
You asked me beforehand, so I assumed you
had
one.
I know, and then I forgot. Sorry, it just evaporated from my brain.
My streaming pick is on HBO Max, and it is a movie that is great, but I think also wound up setting its star on the wrong path. And that would be Rob Reiner's 1989 classic, When Harry Met Sally. Billy Crystal, I think, has it in him to be a great character actor. But he has decided that he wants to play characters that are lovable, and lovable is not really his wheelhouse.
Right.
Even in When Harry Met Sally, even when he gets
he
Sally...
He wasn't lovable in When Harry Met Sally up until, like, the end.
And even at the end, when he finally wins her, he's still quite prickly. And that's charming when he does it. And I think everything Billy Crystal has done since then, both as an actor and in the occasional times that he's been a director, he wants to be loved. And so, you know, you get, does anybody remember Memories of Me or My Giant or Forget Paris or, like, all these other sort of romantic leads he's played that just don't have that same juice? Because he's not written by Nora Ephron, he's not directed by Rob Reiner, and he's not being an a-hole.
Yeah.
But he does it so well in When Harry Met Sally.
Hey, this is from Daniel.
Oh, letters. Yay.
Yeah. Wait. This is about TV. The letter you sent me was about TV.
No. It's about something we said on this show.
We did?
Yes.
I guess I'll read the letter then.
I guess
you can
will.
Tell me what it was we talked about.
Okay.
Because I don't remember.
You never remember.
Daniel says, your struggle with the show Schitt's Creek is why, beyond telling someone I like a show or movie, I don't follow up. If they watch it and like it, great. If not, I'm not going to push. I can tell from Alonzo's voice that he has gone from not liking the show to feeling antipathy toward it.
A little bit. A tiny bit.
I do have to say that I think somewhere that you compared it to Letterkenny, which I think, other than being Canadian, is not really similar to Schitt's Creek in tone or intention.
Well, I mean, you know, it's eccentric small town shows. But right. Yes, obviously they have
and
great many differences.
What were we talking about on this show, on this podcast, about those two television programs?
There was something about sweetie.
So you don't remember either.
I don't remember the specifics. Okay, but
you lied to me and said you remembered and that you were going to tell me what it was.
The other one, which is also about TV, I do remember why. Yes. And generally speaking, you will be the first to admit that we don't stick to topic on any of these programs.
I guess you might have a point.
Yeah.
There. Mm-hmm. I don't know. All right. This is from Greg.
Yes.
I know other people have said this, but I think you both would love Gravity Falls, which is on Disney Plus and Hulu.
Oh.
It's a fun mystery show that references shows like Twin Peaks, X-Files, and Hardy Boys with a childlike innocence, snarkiness, and a sense of wonder. Hearing you try to describe the Mitchells versus the Machines without being too directly... I guess I should maybe read these letters through before I...
It couldn't hurt.
Hearing you try to describe Mitchells versus the Machines without directly referencing Gravity Falls, I'm paraphrasing this sentence, was like describing Empire Strikes Back without having seen Star Wars.
Oh, well, okay.
Anyway, Gravity Falls is one of the best animated shows of the 2010s. I hope you can discuss what you discover on a future episode of Linoleum Knife Television, LKTV. Imagine how developed the Mitchells were in 109 minutes, and then imagine a similar family in 880 minutes.
Well,
40 episodes, 22 minutes each. All right, good, yeah, sure. Oh, look, a 5-star review.
Oh, hey.
And I lost it because it's only one sentence long. And it is sent to us from who?
At the bottom there.
SNL014.
Yes. Lorne Michaels.
5 stars. The 5-star review reads, "My way of learning more about cinema."
Couldn't have said it better ourselves.
Thank you, new friend.
Indeed.
Hey, there's a Patreon.
There is a Patreon.
I'm
going
to tell you all about it.
Won't you?
First of all, this is not just a podcast all by itself. This is one of many podcasts. This one's free. Always been free, always going to be free. Do you like it? Would you like more podcasts like this? Well, then you're going to pay money for them. We have a product. Here we are to sell it. Here's how you get it.
Tell your mom you want Linoleum Knife.
Tell your mom you want Tootsie Roll and the Linoleum Knife family of products. Patreon, you go there and you can subscribe at a variety of levels, dollar amounts, and you'll get the following things. You'll get a show called Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we talk about one film that we haven't reviewed yet on this show, and it can be from the 19-teens to the 2010s. Yeah. Then there's a show called LKTV where we talk about television. Last week, we talked about the Andy Warhol episode of Love Boat.
Yeah, we did.
That existed. It was real. Real weird. Real dumb.
We also talked about the one with the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders where Ginger Rogers sang Love Will Keep Us Together.
Even worse. Then there's a show called Linoleum Knife and Fork where we talk about food. As you may notice from this show, I am frequently talking about food, the food I am making, the food I am eating. Often food is being cooked while we are podcasting. That is currently the case. Monday afternoon. It's 5:15 p.m. There's chicken and rice in the oven, leftover from last night. My Jella Lawson, my queen.
Is orzo rice or pasta?
Oh, did I say rice? I meant orzo pasta, which is a rice
shaped
pasta. Sorry. Anyway, what's the other one?
Linoleum Nights.
Linoleum Nights, where we talk about anything we darn well please, and also we swear, which is what we don't do here.
Correct.
Even though in our real life,
Katie barred the door.
We have a lot of F words that just fly around all day long. Go to patreon.com/linoleumknife. You'll learn more about what's in store for you in our store of podcasts. You pick one off the shelf. You say, I want that one. You subscribe. It's tiered. That means the more you pay, the more you get.
That's right.
Yeah. That's the end of this advertisement for us by us.
I'm on all of those shows, and I'm also on Breakfast All Day with my former What the Flick co-hosts Christy Lemire and Matt Achety, and sometimes Ben Mankiewicz. I'm on the untitled Iffy Dre and Alonzo project. And if you have any ideas for a name for that, we have a contest going on. Visit at Iffy Dre Alonzo for more information about that. And if you want to also participate in Max Fun Drive, hooray. And I'm also on a show called A Film and a Movie on the Bramble Jam Podcast Network. And Bramble Jam is taking the week off because Brand, Dan, and Panda are all taking a vacation. So it's a great time to catch up on episodes of A Film and a Movie. We've had some really amazing guests, and we've covered a lot of really fun films, and I think maybe you'll enjoy it. I also pop in on the actual Deck the Hallmark podcast on Mondays to talk about vintage, made-for-TV, non-Hallmark Christmas movies, and that's been fun. And most recently, I have popped up as a guest on the Travolta Cage Project because they got to The Family Man in Nicolas Cage's filmography, and it's his Christmas movie, so they asked me to come on. And oh, lucky me, it coincides where in parallel in the Travolta filmography, they got to Battlefield Earth.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Oh, yeah.
I'm also guesting on a show called Generation Splice, a millennial film curator and expert, and his boomer psychologist mom talk about films from a generational perspective. Oh. And they needed a Gen Xer to help them talk about Fight Club. So I filled that role for them.
We haven't been apart from each other in 14 months. When did you record this?
Oh, one day or other.
Where was I?
You, where do you always go when I record podcasts? You were in the back in the comfy chair reading or something.
Okay.
Or having a nice nap.
More the case.
Yes.
More likely.
So yeah, so check all of those out. And of course, go listen to our friends on the internet. See what Bibbs and Whitney are up to with Critically Acclaimed. Listen to Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, The Workroom, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. Even if it's a short 5-star review, as you see, we will read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Play, CastBox? Yeah. No. Podbean. I don't know. They all run together after
Florp
a while.
Floop.
thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Check him out at bandcamp.com/BLEU. You can follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be around for the next one. Until then,
goodbye.